This is the Motley Fool Radio Show. I'm David Gardner, and now it's time to go to the Fool Phones. The Fool phone lines are always open, 866-NPR-FOOL. I welcome in Motley Fool personal finance expert, Dayana Yoakum. Dayana, welcome.
Thank you, David.
866-677-3665. Give us a call with your financial question.
And we're going to St. Charles, Illinois, where Sonia's on the line. Hello, Sonia.
Hello.
How are you?
Good, thanks.
Good. What's your question?
Well, there have been several successful IPOs, and well, some of them have moved up and down, but IPOs in the last year have baffled some of us who do technical analysis and try to predict the price movement based on that. One of them is a stock like GuruNet, who the symbol is GRU. We only have the last few weeks, actually 2 months of history with which to analyze the price movement, and it's hard to determine support and resistance. What are the milestones that we can use with IPOs, predictable upwinds and downdrafts that we can be aware of when we're trying to predict price movement other than the technicals?
Right, and you mentioned specifically, was it GuruNet?
GuruNet is one of them. There have been others.
Okay.
Google was one famous one this past year.
I've heard of Google before.
Have we heard of it?
Yeah, I haven't heard of Guru.net. What does that company do?
When I saw the product, I immediately subscribed, which is why I thought other people will do this.
Mm-hmm.
Gives you a little toolbar on the side. It is a search and answer product that you can now. It used to be a subscriber fee. Now it's a free download. They have advertisers, and it gives you answers indicating on any verbal, any word at all on your computer and. Alt click. It's an alter. Hit Alt button and you click on that word. It produces a little pop-up window that gives you a dictionary version. It'll give you encyclopedic answers. You don't have to go to another link. You don't have to log into anybody's anything.
So it sort of smartens up your web browser, and if you encounter a word in a given article, you can click on it with the Alt key, and all of a sudden you see the definition and or internet links, etc.
Yes, very nice.
Right, so it's an example, obviously, of, well, it's kind of a search space company.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what you're asking, Sonia, is how do we actually, specifically looking at companies with young histories on the stock market, they were just born on the stock market within recent history, let's say within the last 6 months, how do we feel about those in general as investors and maybe to the extent anyone can do this, predict their price movements?
Yes, I've heard rumors, I've heard talk, I've seen it that, for instance, Google had sell-offs based on insiders, the owners, legally coming to a point where they were allowed by SEC rules to sell their
mm-hmm.
stock, and they would sell a bunch of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
and
sir.
At that point, there was a downdraft. The stock went down.
You know, I'm glad you mentioned that because that's where I was actually going to start. There is a normal pattern to an initial public offering. That's what an IPO is. It's when a company finally decides to sell a portion of itself to anybody who wants to buy it in the general public. And that's why we have stocks. That's what the stock market does. It allows you and me as members of the general public to become part owners of businesses. So when a company decides to sell a portion of itself and goes public, 6 months to the day after it went public, the so-called lockup date occurs and lockup expires. Insiders are locked up. They are not allowed to sell the shares of the company that they've offered to the public those first 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
It's a way, in a way, you can see, of ensuring that they're serious about it, that their company was not about to explode 2 weeks after it was sold to the public. Your hand is forced. You have to stand pat for 6 months.
So as an investor in an IPO, maybe that's milestone number one or even number two. Before a company goes public, there's the quiet period, and we can always expect that. And it's where, by law, those who work at the company or work with the investment banking firm that's taking the company
mm-hmm.
public to market can't talk about the business lest they sort of drive up the excitement about this IPO.
Well, that would be the fear. And
right.
Yes, they don't want to compromise that offering. So
right.
Dayana and I have now provided two kind of good basic terms. The quiet period, which occurs before that company, the month or so before that company is born in the public markets. And I've identified the lockup date 6 months after when insiders can sell, when sometimes millions of shares are available to be sold. Now, the reality is that often people recognize that ahead of time.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think that all the insiders are all about to sell now all at once, a month before that, you could sell yourself. and that's why a lot of people do speculate in shorter term increments about IPOs and companies coming public. My own approach is to find companies that I really like and would like to be a part owner of for 5 years or more and I usually try to buy some shares in them at a price that I like. Whether or not the company came public yesterday or 15 years ago is almost beside the point, to me anyway. But Sonia, a lot of people do just kind of speculate on IPOs, period. Do you focus just on IPOs or with a portion of your investing thinking?
No, really. I try not to. I try to avoid them because I really didn't know enough about what goes on behind an IPO. Just a little too scary and unpredictable. Usually I use technical analysis on a daily chart and a weekly and a yearly chart to see where I'd go if it were a time to buy. And sort of following trends, if I think the only reason I got involved in GuruNet was because I really thought it was an outstanding product. And I don't get excited about much on the computer. I mostly loathe my computer. But when I saw that, I thought, that's nice. And if schools don't get that, I'd be amazed.
Well, that's great. And that's often the way I look to find my stocks as well, when I've had a good consumer experience or I admire something that someone's doing and I find out, gee, I can be a part owner of that. To put an underline at that at the end of our discussion, insider selling is, to me, often just what happens on a natural basis. More insiders sell than buy all the time. The reason people sell their companies to the public markets is so they can take a portion of their own holdings and sell it to other people and make some money for having started that company in the first place, for example. And so I think insider selling often ignites a lot of fear. You hear those insiders, those greedy corporate types, are selling their shares to caricature what I think often goes on in the minds of many of us. But I think in the end, you just have to look at how much a given insider holds and how much he or she is selling as a percentage of their overall holdings. If somebody is just selling off a little bit here and there, that's a much different thing than if three key players at the company all sell everything they have. And all of that is publicly documented, and you can see it all. So I encourage us all, when looking at insider selling, don't have a knee-jerk reaction. Oh, the insiders are selling. I need to get out. The fact is, most insiders are on program selling, doing it every week or every month in some cases, in little bits over the over long periods of time.
Thank you so much.
I appreciate your call.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Take care. The phone number is 866-NPR-FOOL, and we're going to Lexington, Kentucky, where Lewis is on the line. Hi, Lewis.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. How are you doing?
Doing well. Just fixing to go to class here in a few minutes.
Oh, yeah? What class are you going to?
I think it's supervised ministry. I'm in a seminary class and up at Asbury Theological Seminary.
Oh, interesting. What's on your mind money-wise today?
Well, I was wanting to call and ask you about a stock. It's a hybrid fuel system stock. It's called HYFS. It's an over-the-counter stock, you know, the OB stocks or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, of course, my buddy bought a hybrid car not too long ago and actually sold it for more than he bought it for after he'd driven it 12,000 miles. And so I started getting interested, talked to my brother-in-law about different things, and I found this stock that was selling for about 60 cents, bought about 3,500 shares of it, and now it's at about 90 cents. And I was just wanting to get your opinion on the stock. It, you know, I know it's kind of risky doing the penny stocks or whatever, but I was wanting to get your opinion on what y'all might think about it.
Right. Well, you're right in calling it a penny stock. Any stock that trades, I believe, below $5, is it, David?
Well, you know, it actually is quite subjective what we want to call a penny stock. In general, if it's counted in pennies rather than dollars, I call it a penny stock. So, yeah, Lewis, I agree. That's a penny stock, something that you bought at 60 cents and is up to 90 cents.
And it's traded, you know, as you said, over-the-counter, OTC, which means that it's a company that's probably not stable enough or not established enough to be listed on one of the major exchanges.
That's right. It has not yet qualified. Perhaps it hadn't passed. Sometimes they drop off of the NASDAQ. It doesn't have enough shareholders and shares out there and enough volume on a daily basis to make it qualify for listing on the NASDAQ. So that's why companies are listed over the counter in that way.
But what that also means is because there aren't enough shareholders and interest in the company, that means there's not a lot of coverage of it by, say, mainstream press, which is fine, but also by those who are really sort of watching, keeping tabs on that stock for more fiduciary, you know, responsibility reasons.
That's absolutely true, Diana and Lewis. And I think for that reason, we get more calls probably than usual, Lewis, about penny stocks, because there's no real research out there. And often if you do encounter a research report on a penny stock, it's being junk facts to you, and you probably should be running. And never investing in it. So in general, we do not advocate investing in illiquid penny stocks. It is definitely high speculation in most cases. Often we as investors would be the last ones to hear the bad news. and often would have a hard time finding who to sell our shares to because there's not a big market for these companies. Now, with that said, I'm the first to say, gosh, I wish I'd had a 50% gain, which is what a move from 60 to 90 cents is. And here's where, Lewis, I think you either decide that you are an investor or a speculator in this investment. And,
okay.
And you don't have to be an investor. I mean, we teach investing at The Motley Fool, and that's what we talk about on the show. But it's okay to speculate some. In life, I think it's good to speculate sometimes. Would I speculate with any meaningful amount of money to myself? Not unless I really felt I had an advantage or real knowledge of that. But if you're talking about being an investor, I think we're not spending that much time talking about the stock. We're probably spending time talking about the company, its product, its competitors, and understanding of its industry and its growth rates. And so, Lewis, is that the way that you view this, or are we talking about the stock here?
Yeah, I'm kind of viewing it not as just speculation. You know, I see that there's potential for the hybrid fuel system. I see that, you know, maybe our school buses could go to this, and they offer a program for school buses, and therefore if they get a bunch of school buses, you know, the stock might go up. And I'm looking at, you know, in the future, you know, they got the gas emission, and it's so much better for the environment, and we're trying to help our environment, so maybe this is a future thing.
Right, so you've bought into the Toyota Prius and the whole concept of the hybrid car. You like that. I guess the question here is, if you were trying to sell me this stock, Lewis, and maybe I'll give you a shot here, why don't you give me your best pitch in 20 seconds or less as to why this company would be your selection within that growing industry trend?
Well, they don't owe a lot of money, and they're on the front end of this market. And, you know, they just built a brand-new warehouse, and they're getting more employees every day. And so I feel that, you know, there's so much of a market in the future for this, and so I'm trying to get on the front end of it.
All right.
That way, maybe, you know, maybe it'll kick off for you.
Let's put it this way. You've already found something that's up for you, so you got that going for you. That's good. I would encourage you, as the next step toward making a decision here, to look at the financial statements of the company. And you're saying you're a seminary student, you're not maybe an MBA, so if I say look at the financial statements, I don't want that to be scary to you, but I think if you're going to make good investment decisions, you should feel comfortable looking at the top line of sales growth. What was the company's sales last year? How about the year before that, and what about this year?
Well, yeah, last year, in 2003, they didn't make any money, and last year they made about $30,000, but they spent about $1 million, so they're not doing so hot that way, but every year it's getting more and more.
If what you've told me is true, if the company didn't have any revenues in 2003, it's a development stage company. If in 2004 it still had a speck of revenues and well overspent that, I would view that as the height of speculation. I might well say, I made 50% on this, I'm out! So I'm not trying to ignite any sort of selling frenzy in this or any other stock. You know, if you're telling me that at present it's unprofitable, which is okay, by the way, I like some speculative companies too. My final question for you, and you may not have the answer, but this is what you want to look up. For any company that's losing money that's a smaller company, you need to know how much cash it has in the bank. Just like if we were talking about your friend Bob, and we'd be wondering, well, you know, Bob seems like he's racking up a lot of credit card debt. I would ask, you know, what are Bob's prospects? Can we see his bank account? Is he actually racking up debt? Does he have the capacity to get out of it? So I would want to see the company's cash strength. There are some companies out there, the reason I'm saying this, Lewis, is because some companies will just start selling more shares in order to raise more money from people. Mm-hmm. And that's the only real access they have. And that's a very questionable way of growing a successful enterprise if it's to be successful. So I would want to know the balance sheet. I'd want to know how much cash they have and if they have any debt against that. And I need to know that to understand, you know, what to make of progress in sales this year.
All right. Well, I really appreciate the information and the help. I will go back and look up all that information.
Yeah, I mean, you're already in school, Lewis, so I'm thinking we're just sending you back to another book. I mean, you're already looking at a good book here. Now we're sending you to another one.
There you go. I think we can all learn something every day, right?
Yeah. And in fact, as a seminary student, since you are, Lewis, I want to ask you, because your homework is to look at details about finance. And I'm going to turn and ask you, Lewis, is God in the details? Sometimes we hear that the devil's in the details. Is God in the details, or is the devil in the details? And this is the definitive statement on this program.
I believe that God is in the details. I do believe that. And we have a path we can follow, and some of us decide to follow that path, and some of us don't. And, you know, I think it's all up to the individual.
Thank you for your viewpoint, Lewis. We appreciate that. And what I will close then, and I will say, if you do believe that God is in the details, and I personally am inclined to agree, but if you do believe that God is in the details, study the financial details of any company you invest in.
All right. I appreciate that good word right there.
Good luck, sir.
Thank you, sir. Y'all have a good day.
You too. Is this the penny stocks from heaven angle here?
Pennies from heaven. Pennies from heaven, my friend.
I know why these stocks are attractive to people. It is because often people are just looking at the share price and think it's cheap. It's 60 cents.
That is so often why people buy in the first place, Diana. And then when it goes up, they will call the show and ask, what do I do now? And that's because they're just reacting to short-term movements. And there's no rudder there. You don't know what to make of that. And that's why we always do say, well, what is the business?
Mm-hmm.
How's the company doing? Who's the competition? What are the real prospects here? Unfortunately, a lot of the so-called penny stocks don't have very meaningful ones, but I don't want to demean the whole thing. I mean, there are truly some successful unknown companies out there.
So, David, you're now becoming a penny stock hypester.
I am not a penny stock. I own no penny stocks. I once bought one penny stock, not really understanding what it was. It was a paltry sum of money at the age of 18. It was called Interlab Robotics. They made robots, and I'd heard that they had a contract with China for $40 million of robots. And this is back in 1984. So we're talking over 20 years ago. You can imagine the strength and power of those Chinese robots. And as it turns out, I having paid 1730 seconds, because back then, of course, it was all fractions. 1730 seconds for, I don't know, maybe 100 shares. We're talking less than $100. It briefly rose to 1930 seconds before declining to 0.30 seconds. And that was my one penny stock.
I can just hear the guy in the boiler room. Mr. Gardner, think of it. Picture it. Robots. China.
You know, what I will say is that I was not...
Two huge growth markets.
There was no guy in the boiler room for me. What I was taught by my dad is, don't listen to anybody on the phone. I would never take a cold call and invest in anything.
So you thought that brilliant idea
I read that story in the Wall Street Journal. No joke. The Wall Street Journal, there was a little thing about how Interlab Robotics had received a contract from China.
We need to look them up.
And that wraps up the Fool Phone Lines for this week. The Fool Phone Lines are always open for your financial questions and comments. Yeah, we talk robots. 866-NPR-FOOL. Thank you, Diana. I enjoyed it again.
Yep, it was a great time. Thanks, Dave.
866-677-3665. Give us a call.